Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. During the past decade, three companies have revolutionized the way we shop, socialize, and find information. I'm talking, of course, about Amazon, Facebook, and Google. While these companies have made our lives easier in many ways, my guest today argues that they're also eroding autonomy and individuality. His name is Franklin Foer, and he's the author of the book World Without Mind, The Existential Threat of Big Tech. And today on the show, Franklin talks about how the utopian ideals of Silicon Valley have led to an internet that's becoming more and more homogenized and centralized. We then dig into the vast amounts of personal information these companies collect about us and how they're using it on us. And then Franklin argues while these companies make us feel more autonomous, they're actually diminishing our choices and reducing our individuality. He then provides suggestions on what you can do to maintain your sense of individualism in today's atmosphere. After the show's over, check out the show notes at aom.is/worldwithoutmind, where you find links to resources where you can delve deeper into this topic. Franklin Foer, welcome to the show.
Pleasure.
So you just published a book, World Without Mind, The Existential Threat of Big Tech. Sounds ominous. What was the impetus behind this book?
Yeah, it's a wee bit apocalyptic minded. I wrote this book, I had just gotten fired as editor of The New Republic, which was an incredibly traumatic experience for me. I'd worked at The New Republic for a really long time and had just come off this cycle of where the magazine had been bought by Chris Hughes, who was 28 years old, worth $700 million. He'd been Mark Zuckerberg's roommate in college and one of the first, really a co-founder of Facebook. And he'd arrived at the New Republic with extremely lofty ambitions. He said, "I share your commitment to serious journalism." And the New Republic was a 100-year-old magazine devoted to politics, policy, and fairly high culture. He said, "I share your devotion to seriousness. I've got a lot of money, and you guys have been struggling to master this digital world. Well, I co-founded social media." So it seemed awesome. And for a time, it was extremely awesome. But then there was a moment where he said, "Look, we really need to generate revenue. And the only way for us to do that is to produce pieces that will be very successful on Facebook." And so we lived this just super compressed period in media history where we made this transition from being a magazine that prided itself on its originality and its seriousness to a magazine that was trying to pander to the algorithms of Facebook, trying to produce journalism that would prove to be popular on Facebook. And so It was a really rushed transition, and a new CEO came aboard, a guy from Yahoo. And as soon as he came aboard, I kind of knew that I was doomed because it took him 2 weeks to meet with me. Anyway, so I ended up realizing that I was about to get fired, so I quit, and a bunch of other people quit the magazine, and it became this object lesson in the media about how Silicon Valley was swallowing journalism and why that was going bad. And it just got me thinking along the lines of the ways in which journalism actually was a case study for the broader world, in that everybody in the world is becoming so dependent on these platforms, on Google, on Facebook, on Apple, on Amazon. And I wanted to both productively channel my anger and also explore this problem that was, it'd been extremely interesting to me long before I'd run into trouble at the New Republic.
Right. And it's kind of this idea, the concern about these tech companies has really hit the zeitgeist, because we're seeing it with Amazon, with Facebook, especially Twitter even. I feel like it's like in the air. It's in the social milieu.
Well, when I started writing this book, actually Amazon was really my initial impetus, just because I had been active in the Authors Guild, which is a group that organizes on behalf of writers. And when Amazon had been renegotiating its book contracts with the big publishers, it was applying super brutal tactics and said, "We dominate this market, and basically you have to accept our terms or you're toast." And they would strip, if a publisher was challenging Amazon, they would strip the buy button off of its books, or they would point readers in other directions. And so that was initially the thing that got me interested in these questions. But when I did, when I started writing this book, people looked at me like I was a hippie howling into the wind. These companies had such cultural prestige. And by the time my book came out, the zeitgeist had already started to shift. I think in no small measure, thanks to the election and all the questions about Facebook that arose out of the election. But one radio interviewer last week accused me of mouthing conventional wisdom by criticizing these tech companies. I thought, wow, the zeitgeist really has turned.
Well, before we get into some of these criticisms, I think it's important to understand, because it's amazing, these companies have just risen to power really fast. I think sometimes we take for granted how fast they've come to dominate life, our lives. But I think to understand how that happened, we need to understand the philosophical underpinnings that that exist in Silicon Valley. So what are those underpinnings, and how has that helped them, or sort of not helped them, you know, directed how they've managed their businesses to where they're grown to these giant behemoths?
Well, one of the totally fascinating facts about Silicon Valley is that it wasn't just the birthplace of Apple, the internet, the personal computer. It was also the place where the counterculture came into being. So alongside Steve Jobs, you had the Grateful Dead, you had LSD, you had the communes. And a lot of the spirit of the counterculture rubbed off on technology as technology rubbed off on the spirit of the counterculture. And you had in the late 60s and early 70s, a bunch of people headed off to communes, which was a bit of a doomed experiment. But that real spirit of wanting to tie everybody together in a communal sort of way, of using technology to try to gin up a different sort of consciousness in the same sort of way that LSD had produced a different sort of consciousness, those ideas came to infuse our ideas about technology. And one of the most powerful ideas about technology that we have is this idea of stitching the world together into one and creating these massive new mechanisms, these communes, really, that we can exist in. And that in Silicon Valley, that became the basis for the idea of the network, which is so ubiquitous. Or all these ideas about, we think of Silicon Valley as being kind of libertarian, which it is to a certain extent, but it's also fundamentally collectivist. And you see it in the concepts of crowdsourcing, social media, collaboration, and networking. And these ideas, these networks, these kind of giant communes that they build are beautiful dreams. But when they get captured by big firms, they become the basis for monopoly.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that weird tension between libertarian individualism and this utopian collectivism is really weird, because you do see it. And it's like, I feel like the libertarianism, like there's like a few guys, it's like, well, I'm the guy who can create this utopian collective network. Mm-hmm. And so like that, they encourage like, you know, as little regulations as possible. Yeah. So they can achieve that.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, it's there's a way in which they're just asking for libertarianism for themselves and collectivism for everybody else. And you see what you're getting at, I think, is one of the big themes of my book, which is that there's hypocrisy that runs through a lot of these companies, that they insist on transparency and sharing in everybody else's lives. But when it comes to revealing how their algorithms work, they're completely opaque. Or, you know, Facebook is all about sharing, but they were so reluctant to share basic information about what Russian ads were bought during the campaign.
Yeah. And I mean, so one of the arguments, so this collectivist idea of creating a monopoly, like this is their idea of, a lot of you hear it a lot in Silicon Valley, is monopolies are good.
Yeah.
So why do they, okay, you know, you grew up in high school learning about how monopolies are terrible. Mm-hmm. You had Teddy Roosevelt busting the trust. Right. Why do they think monopolies are a good thing?
Well, I think there's a business principle behind it, which is that they believe that the world operates as a series of networks. And so you can see this, I mean, this is an old idea. I mean, railroads were networks that tied people together. The phone companies operated networks that tied people together. Facebook is a network that ties people together. Google is a network that ties people into Google. And the principle is that these networks work most efficiently when there's only one. It just doesn't make sense for there to be, since Facebook is kind of a global telephone book, it doesn't make sense for there to be two global telephone books, or it's a mechanism for staying in touch with people around the world. Well, what if there were two of them and we were on, it would just be sloppy. And so it's the raison d'etre is kind of this idea of oneness. The business idea is the one of oneness. And so in Silicon Valley, you have the sense that once a firm captures the network, it's not even worth competing with them, because being second place in the network is just not going to yield a huge financial gain. But it is, I mean, there is a way in which all this is very different than the monopolies of old. First is that these guys just possess so much data, which is this intimate window inside your head, this history of everything that you've read, everywhere you've traveled, everything that you've bought, which is then used to kind of increase your dependence on the network to keep you engaged for as long as possible. Or you could even say to addict you to their products. The second thing is that these companies are just so ambitious. So there was kind of a limit to what the railroads could swallow, even as they tried to swallow up a bunch of stuff. And these companies are everything companies. Google started off wanting to organize knowledge. Now it's building self-driving cars. It's got a life sciences company that's trying to defeat death. Amazon started off as the everything store, and now it's a movie studio. It owns the Washington Post. It owns Whole Foods. It powers the cloud, et cetera, et cetera. And there's really no end to the et ceteras.
Yeah. I mean, and what's crazy though, you know, back in the 19th century, going back to the railroads and the telephone companies, even in the middle of the 20th century, is that people, the government and the public were like leery of monopolies, and like they took actions to, you know, break those up. What's changed in the 21st century where people and even the government are like, well, okay, that's, if Whole Foods wants to buy, or if Amazon wants to buy Whole Foods, okay, that's great. So, let's go ahead and do that.
What changed was in the 1960s, there was a famous article written by a law professor called Robert Bork. And Robert Bork would later become famous because Ronald Reagan nominated him to the Supreme Court, and his nomination was derailed by Democrats.
Right. You got borked. You got borked.
He got borked. Right. He got borked. Yeah. All right. So borking, and you know what else got borked? Was our antitrust laws. Because once upon a time, our antitrust laws existed in order to preserve democracy. That there was this fear that once you had private power start to amass into large concentrations, that they would just be able to become way too influential in Washington and in elections, etc. But with Bork, the concern shifted to a concept that he called consumer welfare. And so, in his view, everything was about price. So long as a big company kept prices low, and so long as it didn't use outrageously bullying behavior on customers or on competitors, then there was no problem with it. And so everything in our antitrust laws became about price and efficiency. And that was a big turnaround in the concept of antitrust. And what you've seen is every year since Robert Bork wrote his famous article in the 60s, our interpretation of the antitrust laws has narrowed further and further until, you know, in the Obama administration, I don't think they broke up a company. You know, they did a lot to limit mergers, but this idea that a company has become too big and powerful in its sector and deserves to be broken up is just completely fallen by the wayside, even though that was once something that the government would routinely do.
Right. So Bork did have, I mean, and the monopolists do have a point. Like, it does create lower prices, right?
Absolutely. And just, can I be clear about one thing, which is that I think Google is an incredible invention. I think iPhones are gorgeous pieces of engineering and design. And I don't think we want to throw them all into the ocean and go back to some sort of world before the internet. I mean, not at all. I think we want to try to capture the good parts of it. But when it comes to antitrust, what you're saying is totally true, which is that Google and Facebook are free. Like, you can't argue that they're bad for consumers on those grounds, right? And Amazon keeps prices incredibly low. And so if antitrust is going to have an issue with these, if we're going to care about these monopolies, we need to shift back to a pre-Bork sort of paradigm for considering companies.
So as a threat to democracy or the government or something like that.
Yeah, totally. That's the core threat here. And so not just to democracy and the government, but I also think there are these questions about privacy that loom extremely large. And I do think that there are questions about the ways that they treat competitors. For instance, I mean, a classic example is the way that Google treated Yelp. So once upon a time, when you wanted to go to dinner, you typed in the restaurant's name into Google and a Yelp review came out. And then Google saw that and said, Yelp is a pretty good business. We should be owning that space. And so Google started to aggregate reviews. And what do you know? When you type the restaurant's name into Google, suddenly Yelp got pushed down by the algorithm. And so Google was creating a marketplace that advantaged itself. And so I don't want to completely surrender our causes for economic concern.
Right. And I guess Amazon does this too. Like they're tracking data on which products sell well, and they'll end up just creating that company for themselves to sell that product. There's like a report that came out that like there's a lot of brands that Amazon owns that people don't know that Amazon owns.
Yeah. And I was just reading an article this morning in the New York Times that was describing the way in which Amazon doesn't really like the book publishers, and it's kind of allowed for a shadowy gray market to exist where you can buy books used that are basically review copies that have been purchased or other copies that have been bought on a secondary market, and they use that to undercut the list price that has been set by the publishers and that Amazon seemingly has accepted. And so the point is that Amazon is not operating on the basis of fair market rules. They're not abiding by contracts. They're kind of allowing the system to exist in order to sneakily stick it to these publishers who've been a pain in their ass.
Well, I mean, and besides this threat to, you know, privacy, to democracy, et cetera, I mean, I think one of the underlying threats, you made this pretty explicit, was just these companies are a threat to like just the idea of the individual, or individuality or individualism. Can you explain what you mean by that a little bit more?
Right. Well, I mean, at the biggest level, if you think about it this way, these machines they're just different than other machines, right? So we've had tools ever since we emerged as a species. We've had hammers, we've had plows, we've had factories that have automated upper body strength. But these machines are intellectual machines, and that they're designed to amplify and replace intellectual activities. And a lot of that is great. So I don't need to worry about sense of direction anymore because I've got Google Maps and Waze. But it also means that when I'm merging with my machine, I'm merging with the companies that operate those machines. And these companies have an agenda for influencing us. They have a view of human nature where they're trying to steer us. And it's towards a vision where we're integrated into their systems in the way that they want, that make them the most money. And to me, one of the biggest issues has to do with the ways in which they commandeer our attention. So this is the example that will be, I think, familiar to every single one of your listeners, which is the iPhone it's like constantly beckoning us. If it's in another room, we feel like a limb has been cut off our body. And in this kind of almost Pavlovian sort of way, these phones have been reverse engineered to mean that they're always screaming for our attention. They buzz constantly with notifications. We sleep with our phones, and they're trying to own our attention. They want everything to be on their platforms, and it's incredibly destructive to our ability to have a sense of self, to be individuals when we're just kind of all guinea pigs in this experiment that they're running on us.
Right. Speaking of experiments, like Facebook has admitted to running giant social experiments where they've been able to sway people to do certain things just based on the information they, you know, present to the user.
Totally. And I'm glad that you mentioned that, because when I talk about this, a lot of times I think people look at me like I'm a crank and that I'm concocting some sort of conspiracy. But really, a lot of this is just so explicit that Facebook has submitted to social scientists using its platforms in a way to run experiments on us as individuals, where they try to manipulate our emotional mood, or they try to sway us to go to the voting booth. They're just incredibly explicit about how, you know, if you work for these companies, you know that everything is being tested all the time to maximize engagement, to maximize the amount of time that you spend on a site. And so headlines are being manipulated. The use of photos is being manipulated. The way in which information on Facebook is ordered is being manipulated, all to increase your levels of engagement.
Right. I mean, one of the other arguments you make, sort of the hypocrisy of these companies, is that they say that they've eliminated the gatekeepers, right?
Right.
There's no more publishers, no more editors, no more, you know, people saying what can and cannot, or what is worth, you know, putting out there. But you argue like, no, they're the gatekeepers now.
They are the gatekeepers. They're the biggest, most powerful gatekeepers in a way in human history. And there is this hypocrisy about it. Where they've amassed all this power. Everything flows through their gates. Journalism is hugely dependent on Facebook and Google for traffic and therefore for revenue. Publishing is totally dependent on Amazon. And they're just massive chunks of the economy that are dependent on these companies. And these companies have the ability to pick winners and losers. What Facebook decides comes up highest in its algorithms are going to be the things that are going to be most popular. The things that they decide to suppress in their algorithms are going to be the things that don't get attention. And it's an incredible amount of power, yet they claim to have, they refuse to admit that they hold that sort of power, which is part of the reason why they've come under such heated attack right now after the election. That we can see that they created a system in which fake news propaganda have flourished, the ways in which it was so easy for bad actors to come into their system and to use it in order to manipulate people. Yet Facebook was incredibly reluctant to admit that it had any responsibility over any of that.
And going back to the consumer, how these monopolies hurt consumers. Okay, we get free information, low prices in Amazon, but you know, you argue that like the quality of that information we get for free has gotten crappier.
Yes.
Right? Because exactly. Like your example of the New Republic is a great example. First, you know, it took pride in writing these very long form, in-depth, thorough articles, and then you were left having to write clickbaity, you know, won't believe what happened next type stuff in order to drive traffic, because that's what does well on these social platforms.
Right, exactly. And that it's created, this is another way in which it's kind of destroying individuality, which is that everybody who depends on Facebook is constantly trying to latch onto the thing that's trending, that is most popular there. Because what Facebook wants are the things that are going to be popular. Those are going to be the things that will keep people most engaged. And so there's this shift in ethos towards the Facebook ethos, which Facebook looks like it's promoting individual expression. And it does to some extent. But on balance, you'd have to say that it's also created a new herd mentality, a new form of conformism and homogenization.
Right, right. Yeah, and I guess another example, you talk about the publishing industry, how Amazon allows anyone to publish a book, but a lot of those books are just garbage.
Unfortunately.
Right. I mean, you have people just cranking out, like especially in the fiction world, just cranking out like fiction books, like faster than just like these like dime store, you know, Westerns from the 19th century. Just trying to make as much money as possible. But Amazon allows that.
Well, Amazon doesn't just allow it. It encourages it, because it's a thing that Amazon is no different than these other companies. They want addictive products. It's true in the realm of television and video, by the way, too, where the quality is sometimes higher. But this idea of binge watching is again, they want your attention for as long as possible. And we're just in the early days of the ways in which that's going to be monetized. I mean, as Amazon turns more and more to advertising, your binge watching is going to be a bigger and bigger source revenue for them. And so this is not a new phenomenon. We've always been, the couch potato is a time-honored American tradition, but given the data that they have and the way that they understand you, their ability to addict you is going to be much, much higher. And the quality, but just to return to what you're trying to bring out of me, which is this point about quality, which I think is hugely important. Because if you think about it, as citizens, we have to make really important decisions every couple of years about who gets elected to public office. And in order to make good decisions, we need to have good information. And if Facebook is just giving us what it thinks that we want, it means it's confirming our biases, and it's in some ways intellectually incapacitating us. And so the implications for democracy are pretty catastrophic.
Yeah, no, so the existential threat. Another thing, like talking about the democratization and like the worsening of quality of content, like Instagram comedians are the bane of my existence and YouTube comedians, like they're not funny at all, but they do they do well on the platform for some reason. I don't know. I'm on this mission to take down Instagram comedians. All right. We'll see if we can make it happen.
I hadn't really fully appreciated the ways in which my thesis could be spun off and applied to other vectors of human life.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think Jerry Seinfeld has complained about that before. Comedians and, people who write for television, they had to they were put through the ringer, right? You no longer have to do that. And so as a consequence, you don't really get the cream anymore rising to the top.
Right.
Well, so I mean, what's the solution to this? Is it just, okay, you said it's like we don't have to give up on the internet, but what do we do to counter that? Or if, what can we do on a personal level and maybe on a societal level?
Right. So we've talked a little bit about some of the policy solutions, about the return, the possibility of taking those anti-monopoly laws that have grown so dusty and hauling them off the shelf and applying them. I think we could think of breaking up some of these companies. The Europeans are moving to, in a way, break up Google, try to sever some of its advertising business from some of the search business. Could easily imagine doing the same thing to Facebook here. It's gobsmacking, just truly gobsmacking, that there's no law protecting your data, given how intimate, we tell our machines things that we would never tell our friends. And these companies are sitting there holding that data, sometimes selling it on an open market, and it needs to be protected. On a personal level, let me ask you a personal question. Do you sleep with your phone?
I don't.
Well, God bless you. When did you decide to give that up, or did you never do it?
I just never really did it. Wherever my phone ends up, that's where it ends up, and that usually is not by me. So there's that. I also don't have a personal Facebook account.
Wow.
I stopped.
You are the resistance.
I am the resistance, and it's for that reason. Like, because I'm just freaked out by how much Facebook can know about you. So I was I gotta stop that.
Well, I mean, look, it's really hard. It's almost better to not start than to engage and try to disengage, because the human reasons for kind of being drawn to these devices, the way in which we crave attention, the way in which we, all of our anxieties and insecurities are amplified by these devices, is kind of horrifying. And once you're stuck in their experiments, it's very, very hard to get out. And so, I mean, I struggle with this. I honestly struggle with this. I don't have Facebook on my phone anymore. I killed all the notifications on my phone. I try not to sleep with my phone, although there are nights where I find myself kind of doing it. because I want to listen to a podcast, say, because I, you know, you decide that you need your alarm and you don't have an old fashioned alarm clock nearby because you're traveling or what have you. And Facebook is just damn, it's like, I don't really do a whole lot of posting on it, but the voyeuristic aspect of it is so real. And I don't know if you use Twitter, but it's like when you tweet something, you sit around waiting for to see how people respond to it. And it's like this craving of affirmation and this desire not to say something that causes people to shame you. I mean, it's really the emotions that they're messing with are really, really powerful. I would just say that we've got lots of other powerful forces in our lives when it comes to the foods that we eat and our compulsion to chow down, or there's alcohol or what have you. And we learn to eat and drink with relative moderation, except for some outlier cases. And I think it's possible, even despite all the powerful forces at work, to do the same thing with technology, just to use it in a balanced sort of way where you're able to reap its benefits without permitting yourself to be a lab rat in their experiment.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't have a problem with like the social networks, Facebook or Twitter. Like Amazon's the one that freaks me out, because we do have Alexa in our house, and I don't know about Alexa. I'm a little suspicious of her now. I don't know if she's like always listening to what I'm saying. Could be. I don't know.
Whoa. I mean, it's amazing you even have a question about that. Of course, Alexa's always listening.
Well, yeah, that's right. If you say Alexa, she's like, what's up?
Yeah.
But is she also listening to just conversations? I mean, they could do that, right? Amazon could sneak in something in their terms of service. They're like, we do this. And then when you go to Amazon.com, you see an ad or you see like a product, recommended product for this thing you were talking about with your wife, right? That could happen. That's creepy. That is really creepy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's kind of the design, right? Is that you're supposed to be, the idea is that these companies, these devices are supposed to know you in a way that better than you know yourself. And that way they can anticipate your desires, and they can, I mean, this is another aspect in which individualism and individuality are threatened, is that these companies want you to offload decision-making onto them. So here's the creepiest thing that I think is bubbling up, which is, I don't know if you listened to either Zuckerberg or Elon Musk talk about how they want to read your brainwaves.
Right. Yeah. I don't like that.
I don't know how the hell that could happen. I mean, it seems so outrageous to me that could actually be developed just on a scientific level. I don't get it. But then again, I never really imagined that you'd have a handheld device where you'd be able to watch every television show ever created or every book ever read. That was like a fantasy that was kind of beyond my wildest imaginations as a kid. So maybe they can pull it off.
Maybe they pull it off. Yeah, they want you to become part of the hive mind. The new, what's it, new, N-U-U or something like that? I don't know.
The idea that Facebook could, like, I wouldn't even need to type. I could just think and it would suddenly post, or it would suddenly reveal whatever my inner thoughts are. I mean, it seems to me to basically, that kind of exposes the agenda of the company, right? That's their next end goal. I mean, that is the complete disappearance of privacy when somebody's able to read your brain.
Yeah, like Zuckerberg has made that, like he wants that to happen. Like he says, we want, like he wants to get rid of privacy.
Yeah.
Because he says it's good for society, right? Like you put it all out in the air.
Look, if your girlfriend knew, like if there was a possibility of your girlfriend knowing that you were cheating on her, you wouldn't cheat. And that's kind of basically what he's saying because of that. And that's basically what he's saying, that if our public selves merged with our private selves, we'd be morally better human beings. And we would also, he also claims we would be more forgiving of other people, because everybody would constantly be making mistakes, and those mistakes would be exposed. So you're right. I mean, it's I find it fascinating to sit there and read through everything that he said on the subject, simply because it's so radical and there's such a loud view of human nature embedded in right. what he's saying, and it creeps the hell out of
yeah. me. And then also going back to the idea of diminished individuality, like if you know your thoughts are being read, like you are less likely to engage with possibly, I don't know what to say, just like risky thoughts, like risky ideas, which that could put a stifle on all sorts of things, scientific advancements in psychology, et cetera, et cetera.
Were you just reading my brain right now?
Yeah, I was.
Because eerily, that was what I was thinking.
No, but you're already kind of seeing that already. People censor themselves, self-censor online, because you might get, it gets picked up on Twitter, and then the mob comes out with the pitchforks. And
well, it's not even just on Twitter. Here's an example from everyday life, which is when I was started working, offices were a thing then, and so you had doors that you could close while you were working, and people would come into your office, and you could talk behind closed doors with them. And so if you had an idea that you were thinking about for some new thing, you could tell somebody that new idea in private without worrying about the embarrassment of saying something stupid or saying something that was offensive. But now everybody works in an open office space, and conversations happen on Slack or other chat platforms. And so every idea is now turned around in public. And so if you have a new idea, you're not closing the door. You have to think before you post. And so you become more cautious in pitching new ideas. You become more terrified about offending or about you become, as you say, less subversive. You become less innovative. You become flattened as an individual in that type of environment.
Right, which goes against the argument that the Silicon Valley people make that open source stuff leads to better things. Not necessarily the case.
No, I don't know why. I mean, these things become so ideological in Silicon Valley, where openness, transparency, these things become mantras that they try to force onto everybody else. All right, in some instances, they're great and they work really well. Like Wikipedia is an amazing thing, and we don't want Wikipedia to disappear. It's a great example of collaboration working. But I don't think that's necessarily should become our foundational belief for the future of human civilization, which is the way that they tend to carry their ideas.
So I'm curious, have you noticed any weird things with your book on Amazon or Facebook because of the things you say about them?
Yeah, man. I don't know why I'm not number one on the New York Times bestseller list. I think it's Amazon keeping me down. No, I don't think they're messing with me.
Right. Yeah. As I was reading this, I was like, I wonder if Amazon's going to put the kibosh on his book. Well, hey, Franklin, this has been a great conversation. Where can people go to learn more about the book?
Well, there's this invention called the internet. I don't love it in its entirety, but I like a lot of it. And if you were to go to, fire up DuckDuckGo or Bing.
DuckDuck, yeah. That's what I use for search. That's my default search too. I'm trying to like do what I can to fight. I'm part of the resistance.
Or you know what? Here's something I want to let your listeners know, a secret. If you get in your car somewhere within proximity of your house, I think that there might be a store where they sell books.
Oh yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
It's not Amazon. Go to a store.
No, I mean, look, far be it for me to dissuade your listeners from buying my book on Amazon. If they bought my book on Amazon, look, I know your podcast is a judgment-free zone. So I don't think that they should feel any sense of social opprobrium for doing that.
We're big proponents of being an individual, rugged individual. You do what you want.
Yeah.
All right. Well, hey, Franklin Foer, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Okay. Real fun. Thank you.
My guest today is Franklin Foer. He's the author of the book, World Without Mind, The Existential Threat of Big Tech. It's available, of course, on Amazon, which we talked about today. Or if you don't want to do that, go to your local bookstore and pick up a copy there as well. Also, check out our show notes at aom.is/worldwithoutmind, where you can find links to resources where you can delve deeper into this topic. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. If you enjoy the podcast, I've gotten something out of it, I'd appreciate it if you take 1 minute to give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. Helps out a lot. And if you've done that already, thank you so much. Please share the show with your friends. That's how the show grows, is word of mouth. As always, thank you for your continued support. Until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.